I'm going to tell stories. So I'm going to suggest that I take you to, this slide just to show that I don't have any conflicts to disclose. And then I'm going to take you to the Eastern Shore of Maryland when I was a health officer in 1997. This is a lovely picture of one of our rivers on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And fishing and crabbing is a phenomenal way of life there. It's peaceful. These are very wonderful people. Maryland is a crabbing community. We love our crabs. I'm not much of a seafood person, but my wife told me they're wonderful. But this is a group of folk that just, you know, this way of life has persisted for many years in Maryland. And of course, fishermen are dependent on fish. And we, of course, get a call one day that there have been fish kills on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And of course, our folks that are in this business do the things they usually do. They look at the fish, they measure the oxygen content, because as you know, though, you may know, the usual cause of these large fish kills is environmental, and the oxygen content of the water has diminished, and they basically suffocate. Or there's some other toxin that gets in the water. But we were having these random fish kills all around the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And the challenge was the fish were growing up and had these sores. And apparently there were some case studies of this phenomenon actually occurring as well in North Carolina among fishermen in North Carolina, where they had begun doing research on some of the causes of these fish kills. In Maryland, as in North Carolina, we also begin to have these watermen with a range of health complaints, from headaches to skin rashes and lesions, interesting neuromuscular symptoms, even reports of amnesia. And, of course, when that happens, of course, the health department certainly gets brought in. And we had a big meeting between the Department of Natural Resources, many of the water researchers in the state, and the health department. To try to figure out what's going on. And we began talking to our colleagues in the health department in North Carolina, and it turns out that there was certainly believed to be a new organism at this time called Fisteria, which is a dinoflagellate. It's a new organism. It has multiple life forms. There's still a lot of controversy, by the way, about whether or not Fisteria actually causes health diseases. We do believe the organism itself actually exists. But the root cause, of course, for this is that the environment has been basically changed. Animal waste. Maryland is a state which has a large amount of chicken farming on our eastern shore. And as you can imagine, those nutrients go into the waste goes into the river, changes the nitrogen content, and a range of environmental issues in the water. In the Northern Virginia and North Carolina, where they also had similar types of fish kills, they were also are lots of pig farming, similar types of waste that goes into the rivers. And of course, the public health intervention here was because we were very much concerned that there was a human health link to this, and I would commend you to a book called When the Rivers Turn to Blood, which is a fascinating story about this phenomenon in North Carolina. Again, I need to reiterate, there's a lot of controversy about all of this, but I lived it, and I was actually there when we did the health assessments for the watermen. The deputy, you always get the task of hopping in the van and going down and doing the medical assessments while everybody else does the press conferences back at the university. And we looked around the state. We actually called the CDC line to try to find the world's expert in dinoflagellates. It turns out it was Glenn Morris at the University of Maryland. So instead of calling Atlanta, we just had to call down the street. And the other expert on red tides, of course, was at Johns Hopkins. So we put together a really superb team of experts to go down and see if we can make a link between the human health effects of this and the changes in the water. But nonetheless, many people thought that at least for some period of time, this organism produces theoretically a toxin that made people sick. And so we began closing rivers, just as you would for an E. coli outbreak in those rivers. Based on some concept of when we thought the rivers were safe to reopen, we reopened them. But of course, that had huge economic implications for the fishermen in those areas. We began educating watermen, doing environmental action more broadly around trying to make sure the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries, the rivers, were cleaner. But you can see the various groups that we partner with to really try to better understand this phenomenon and the partnerships, even with the farmers, that we had to have in order to try to address this real significant crisis in the state. Lonnie already talked a bit about this, but in New York City, 1999, primarily and initially in areas like the Bronx in New York City, Bronx Zoo noticed that it had a fair number of exotic birds that were dying. In the community, of course, they were beginning to find dead crows. And actually, the health department was chasing an outbreak of encephalitis among seniors primarily in New York City. And so you had these dual epidemics, an outbreak of encephalitis, dead birds, and when some of the health department officials were actually in the community having press conferences and doing community assessments around the encephalitis, they would have people walk up to them and say, well, yeah, doc, but what about the dead birds we're finding all over the place? Eventually, these two dual epidemics came together, dead birds and tragically some dead people. People began to notice the similarities in the necropsies of their brains. Eventually, folks, of course, figured this out. We had a common epidemic of West Nile virus. First outbreak in our hemisphere, a new organism. Who knows how it got here? Maybe it rode on the back of a mosquito, as Lenny points out, in the back of an airplane from somewhere. There is a cycle that occurs. And disease tracking, of course, was very important here. I remember as a health officer, we all were prepared. We were watching what was going on in New York, and we were at least wise enough to begin preparing our communities for this event, whatever it was, in terms of it was coming down the coast. And Maryland actually was the next state. I don't know why the birds skipped over New Jersey and Delaware, et cetera, but I remember getting a call from the governor's office about our first dead bird in Baltimore City. And, of course, it was a fascinating activity because we had, like many health departments, had begun doing dead bird pickups and sending those birds for analysis to CDC, to the Denver Center and CDC, and they were doing necropsies on the birds, and they were doing some immunological tests to try to figure out once they knew it was a West Nile virus species. And of course, somehow a reporter got wind of the fact that we actually had the first West Nile virus positive bird outside of New York City was in Maryland. And, of course, that hits the news. The interesting part about this was that, because, you know, a news story from a public health perspective isn't really a big news story if it's a one-day story and if they don't have art. But unfortunately, it turns out that the reporters, as we were picking up dead birds, had just casually started, the cameramen were going around and just filming dead bird pickups. And, of course, they recorded where those dead birds were from. And so they made a connection between a dead bird and some cameraman remembered, you know, I think I filmed that bird. And so unfortunately they had the dead bird on in a TV a movie, a video, and they were able to show this art, and it caused enormous panic. The good news is the frost came, the mosquitoes went away, and we didn't have to deal with it that season, but we did have to deal with it very rapidly the next year, because the next year we had lots of dead birds in the community. And we all began to do surveillance activities for encephalitis, looking for birds, recognizing that the horses were also involved. Maryland has a big racing industry as well, so this was a big issue in Maryland. among the racing industry. And of course, there were concerns about people's pets. People love their pets, and that became a big deal. And of course, we began doing mosquito surveillance. You know, the real challenge here was the fact that over many years, we have just taken apart most of our mosquito surveillance programs in the United States, tragically. And so we began to have to begin to rebuild those in a variety of ways. And of course, you had this transmission cycle between mosquito and birds, mosquito to horses, mosquito to people. Horses and people tended to be the end part of the cycle, but it was a real challenge for us, with birds and mosquitoes kind of being the replicator for the disease. And of course, the public health intervention caused some other concerns, because having to deal with our environmental colleagues and people who are concerned about spraying of insecticides in communities. As it always is, the first bird we had in Maryland was in the Inner Harbor of Maryland, on the side of the harbor where the homes cost $500,000. And so a very, very environmentally active community. And we wanted, of course, to discuss spraying in that community. And that was the practice initially at the time. And, of course, we did all the things we needed to do around eliminating standing water and classic mosquito control efforts. But it required a lot of public education and partnerships, which, again, we continue to do today. I then bring you to Villa Park, Illinois in 2003 to your friendly pet store. Well, these two critters were neighbors. One of those was the prairie dog on the left and the giant Gambian rat on the right. And these folks, you know, this was a big issue around the importation of animals into the United States. And I can also tell you that while they not only were neighbors in pet stores, but we have these pet marks all over the country where people, just like firearms and just like flea markets, people trade pets, sell pets, all the time. And lots of exotic pets get traded this way. But the this giant Gambian rat was infected. And we began to see people with pox-like lesions. Now, I want to take you back to that year and remind you of some of the other concerns that were going on in the country at that time. You may remember that there was a great deal of concern about bioterrorism. We were having a national debate about smallpox and the return of smallpox, a disease which fortunately really doesn't exist in human beings today, but we know where there are stores, both at the CDC and theoretically in Russia. And so seeing a pox-like lesion, which microscopically, with an electron microscope, actually looks like the smallpox virus, caused enormous panic within the public health preparedness community, the homeland security community, and trying to figure out where this pox came from. And of course, it's monkeypox. And of course, with these two animals being neighbors, this certainly got out into the prairie dog community. Certainly became a multi-state investigation, both to find the cause and to try to figure out what to do about it, and a lot of debate about what do we deal with animals that come into the country, both FDA and CDC, who both have some regulatory oversight over small animals, were very much involved. And you see here, again, the giant Gambian rat, theoretically brought the disease into the United States, passed it on to prairie dogs, and then, of course, to humans. The big debate, just like we have had with turtles around Salmonella and some other small animals about whether or not we should ban them, occurred. I can tell you that most of my experience in public health, I don't really have a lot of community members very upset. It's like you want to close a schoolhouse or close a fire department. But I can tell you that the public hearings around getting rid of people's prairie dogs, guinea pigs, and things like that was enormous. A lot of issues there. It's a real challenge. And I don't think we ever regulated. I think we tried to regulate it and they had to back off. The fact that these animals can come into the country, and can be infected is a huge hole in our quarantine system. There is very difficult to track these animals, particularly with these pet marks, but it does require an enormous partnership between veterinarians, pet shop owners, pet owners, in order to truly address this significant zoonotic disease. And of course, 2002 in China, well, we know that SARS developed, as you know, that certainly became a worldwide epidemic, initially thought to be in bats, but I think the civet cat is probably the critter that folks think that's actually probably the main culprit here in SARS. It obviously is very a new organism, which again had significant implications because both of its infectation, how infectious it was, as well as its mortality in certain populations, and ultimately resulted in really a worldwide epidemic. The fact that we didn't have a vaccine, and the fact that coronaviruses, like cold, the common cold, are very, very tough to get your hands around, resulted in significant issues around hand washing, masks, whether the basic paper masks work, whether or not you need to use something more sophisticated in terms of a mask, the whole issue of isolation and quarantine. As you know, people were actually quarantined in hotels while they figured out whether or not someone was infected, had come from a particular hotel. Hospitals were closed. Hospitals were quarantined. Again, lots of partnerships there. The traditional health partners, including zoologists and farmers, were involved. There is vaccine in development. I don't think the vaccine has been finalized, but I think it's out for human trials right now. So One Health partnerships are key is really my message, is that these are real. They're not theoretical. They happen every day. I've had to live them during my life as a health officer. And you can imagine the number of other of these outbreaks that we've seen, including MERS, which is the most current one. Again, highly lethal that we're concerned about. And the question is, what do you do with our camels, which is one of the animals, of course, in which that the MERS virus is thought to infect. We know we're going to need to have capacity to do significant surveillance to detect these new and emerging diseases, to begin to confirm these diseases through a range of laboratory tests, inform stakeholders, and come up with new ways to treat and contain these diseases is very, very important. So with that, I will stop and turn it over to the next speaker. Thank you.